Good evening. Welcome to the Salieri Report. Today is Thursday, March 10th, 2011. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, Precious Metals Market Report. I'm going to start with money and markets and then reserve questions to share them with Franklin. I want to encourage you. Last week, we had Blake Levitt doing electromagnetic fields. I posted a new op-ed by her about smart grids. We spent about the last 10 minutes of the interview last week talking about smart grids, and it's a very important topic. I encourage you to listen last week, take a look at that op-ed, and I've invited Blake to come back and later in the spring to just do a show on smart grids. I think it's that important, so more on that soon. Our theme tonight is, does debt matter? You betcha. And I want to read to you the opening and closing paragraphs from a report that Kyle Bass just sent to his investors. He's a hedge fund operator. We continue to be very concerned about systemic risk in the global economy. Thus far, the systemic risk that was prevalent in the global credit markets in 2007 and 2008 has not subsided. Rather, it has simply been transferred from the private sector to the public sector. We are currently in the midst of a cyclical upswing driven by the most aggressively pro-cyclical fiscal and monetary policies the world has ever seen. Investors around the world are engaging in an acute and severe cognitive dissonance. They acknowledge that excessive leverage created an asset bubble of generational proportions, but they do everything possible to prevent rational deleveraging. Interestingly, equities continue to march higher in the face of European sovereign spreads remaining near their widest level since the crisis began. It is eerily similar to July 2007, when equities continued higher as credit markets began to collapse. And then his last paragraph, we ask ourselves and urge you to ask yourself one simple question, does debt matter? It was excess leverage and credit growth that brought the global economy to its knees. Since 2002, global credit has grown at an annualized rate of approximately 11%, while real GDP has grown approximately 4% over the time frame. Credit growth has outstripped real GDP by an astounding 275%. We believe that debt will matter like it has every time since the dawn of financial history. Without a resolution of this global debt burden, systemic risk will fester and grow. Now, what's interesting is Bass is talking about the debt as if it was a financial system. And as I've said before, at this point we're looking at a debt system which is, if anything, a politically managed system or a real control system. And I'd like to just step back and look at the same thing he said in this sort of theme of does debt matter, you betcha. During the 90s, as we've talked about many times, trillions of fraudulent paper was issued and then bailed out by sovereign governments. And that's the process of, as Bass referred to, shifting the debt from the private to the public purse. Now, what does that mean? It means the people who engineered that fraudulent paper now have a war chest. Think of it as like a shopping kitty. And if you've ever seen those shows where somebody with a shopping cart gets to go into a grocery store and they have 5 minutes to fill up their cart and get everything. We're literally watching people all around the world buying up all the real stuff. So they've stuck the government with the debt, and they have trillions of dollars. And what that means is all the assets are in play, literally all the assets in the world. Now, when I say all the assets, what does that mean? Well, the first thing it means is global pension funds. Global pension funds are now estimated to be $31.1 trillion. That's twice the size of the last year's GDP in the United States, about $14.7 trillion. In the United States, a lot of that is state and local government pension funds. And what we're watching, and Franklin and I are going to talk more about what's going on in the reengineering of state everything, but what we're watching in Wisconsin, among other things, to pluck those assets, you have to take down some of the union power and the power of the public employees, including the teachers, because the pension funds, the teachers are a big component of public pension funds. But there are other assets. They're bank deposits, their purchases and contracts. Taking on the teachers is important, again, because if you're going to outsource school management and school facilities to corporations, you can pump up a lot of stocks. We have land such as state parks, We have operating businesses such as municipal power operations and power plants. I've referred several times now to the provision in Wisconsin to do no-bid contracts or no-bid sales of the state power plants. Literally, trillions of dollars can be transferred, and we saw that happen in other countries around the world, in Russia and Latin America and Eastern Europe during the 90s. It can happen here. And the squabble about the debt is at the very heart of making that reengineering. So our theme is, you know, does debt matter? You betcha. And what I want you to think of is you sort of watch this game unfold. Think just debt equals not only war, but debt equals reengineering. And what we've seen in the last 2 weeks is a real indication that the reengineering of everything is really going to continue to accelerate this year. We expected it, but it's even surprising me the speed at which it looks like it may happen. Okay, money and markets. China posted an unexpected $7.3 billion deficit. It's the largest in 7 years. That means in the first 2 months of 2010, China had a $22 billion surplus. This January, February, it's almost a $1 billion deficit. So that's a very big swing. We saw the markets down in Asia. We've been waiting in the United States for a big break in the market one way or another. All indications was we were in for a big break. We just didn't know which way. Sharply down today, so we'll see what tomorrow means. What it tells me, though, is the oil card that we've been talking about is really working. Somebody asked me today if I thought we were close to World War III. I said, what do you mean close? We're already in it. If you look at the number of events happening in the Middle East and around the world, pipeline explosions, problems with the refineries, we're literally watching a war to keep the oil price up that's very covert but very, very intense. And many, you know, some of the issues of what's going on in the Middle East are very much related, not just to the inflation that comes, or the food price inflation and energy price inflation that's coming out of the monetary policies, but literally an effort to reengineer things just as it is here. And part of that is keeping up the oil price. And again, if you haven't listened to our interviews with Jim Norman and read his book, The Oil Card, it really is one of my top 10. And so this is all part of the integration of war with economy that we've been watching, but definitely globally World War III is underway. From Kiplinger's this week, an estimated $1.6 trillion deficit in 2011. This is the United States. That's a staggering national debt of $15.5 trillion. The United States government, federal government, now borrows 40 cents of every dollar spent. If we wanted to balance the budget in 2012, we'd have to scrap all discretionary spending, big pieces in defense, just to balance the budget. What Kiplinger says is that no party is going to address it before the next elections. And what that means is afterwards, then it's all on the table, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and a reengineering of the tax code. Look for the retirement ages to go up as we've seen them go around the world, but they're going to have to hit on entitlement spending. In Wisconsin, we see the legislature move with the Republicans without the Democrats, looking to find sort of legislative ways to get their legislation passed without the Democrats coming back into state. A great interview on Democracy Now! By Naomi Klein, who likens her shock doctrine process to what's happening and mentions that there are now 16 states where collective bargaining is literally trying to be brought down. And there's very little understanding. Klein's interview is very good. We'll have it up on the blog tomorrow. But there's very little understanding of what this is a prelude to, because before you can outsource a lot of the state functions to corporations, before you can sell off a lot of these assets, before you can start to do more with the pension funds, you need to get the state employees out of the way and the teachers out of the way. I mean, as soon as you can quickly hire and fire teachers and public employees, then there's a lot you can do to basically asset strip the state governments in the United States. But Klein sort of tees up that issue, and it's an interview worth watching. We saw Michael Moore go to Wisconsin and give a speech, again, up on the blog, where he says America is not broke, and describes very much what we talked about last week when I said it's a big lie. And, you know, one way to think about it is we've talked about the $4 trillion that went missing from the federal government and then the $12 trillion plus in bailouts. So when you sort of take a thing down for $4 trillion and then you take it down for $12 trillion, and then you say, well, the problem the thing has is broke, so we have to cut you. The problem is not that we're broke. The problem is we can't afford to keep placating the people who stole $4 trillion and $12 trillion. We need to literally deal with a governance issue of, you know, who stole it, how do you get it back. But the problem is not that we're broke. If you look at America, it has tremendous, tremendous wealth. The problem is that we're currently running the system on a negative return on investment basis. It's not sustainable. That means we have to change. But it's not just all of the people getting Social Security have to change. It's all the people who gorged on the $4 trillion, $12 trillion, and wherever it went. We're watching. I did a big blog post this week on the state legislative efforts to make precious metals an alternative medium of payment in the state, both with business or the government. Utah has now passed in both House and Senate, and it's going up to the governor's office for signature. Let me just read you a few from a report from Salt Lake City. Utah might be one step closer to its own gold standard after the Senate approved today, a bill that required the state to recognize gold and silver coins as legal tender. Our hope is to help stabilize the currency within our own state long term, said Senate Majority Leader Scott Jenkins. The bill passing 17-7 makes the exchange of federally issued gold and silver coins an option for businesses and individuals, though it does not mandate it. The bill also requires gold and silver coins to be valued at their current market value. The Senate approved sending the measure to the Tax Review Commission and revenue, blah, 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 blah. Okay. Well, it's much more going on, change accelerating, and a lot of what's happening at the state level I also want to talk about with Franklin in our precious metals market report. Now, I just realized that, you know, I never give Franklin a proper introduction. I just assume you all know him because he's on every month, and he and I have been in cahoots for just a very long time now. But I thought I would take a little bit of time to just, because some of you are new to the Solari Report, to introduce Franklin properly. Franklin hails from mid-Tennessee. He has a very successful precious metals dealership, The Money Changer, and also a very successful newsletter that I'm an avid reader of, also The Money Changer. I recommend it to you if you haven't read it. And he also is the busiest man in America. He and his family, he lives on a farm. And he's got about six kids around him, and they each have families. And they have the top-of-the-world farm, and they've been teaching themselves how to raise livestock and grow food and live much more with what I would call fresh food freedom than most people. And to top it off, they decided they should also build a church, which I'm now a member of, which is arguably, outside of the great cathedrals, one of the most beautiful churches I've ever seen, Christ Our Hope in West Point, Tennessee. So these are very busy people. And the interesting thing about the Sanders family is they're always learning. They're always learning. They're always networking. They're always open to any new idea about what works. They're always trying something new. They're very focused on action, building, building, building. They work hard, play hard. I've never said this so Franklin could hear me, but Franklin, you're going to hear me now. I always say that Susan Sanders, is Franklin's incredible wife, that Susan and Franklin are the people who best prove that righteousness is sexy. And the thing I really admire and value about Franklin is they, as I talked about last week, he and his family never, ever wait for the other shoe to drop. They're much too busy building a beautiful world. So this is the original guy to take action. And if you haven't plugged into Franklin's website or his newsletter, I recommend it. So, Franklin, I hope you're with us.
Well, I'm here.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
And he also, you have a great piece about your history. Franklin's the only guy who had a tougher fight with the feds than I did. Or at least that's what James Hirk says. But you have a great piece on your blog called The Most Dangerous Man in the South.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, so there is so much that has happened in the precious metals market since we talked to you last, Franklin. I don't know where to start, but I'm hoping you do. Can you bring us up to date?
Well, silver went crazy. Just kept going up and up and up and up. And whenever you get a straight up market like that, the problem for folks who are not used to trading very much is that it looks great to them, but they don't realize that a straight up market is a kind of, it's like a person who has some sort of terrible infection. It's like their fever, you know. It's a feverish move. It's a paroxysm, and they just don't last forever. They look real nice. They're a lot of fun, but eventually, to change metaphors, the party is over. The cops arrive, and it's not any fun anymore. You know, you always get sharp falls off of those rises. The problem is, you can't be sure today was the beginning of that sharp fall. Silver, as crazy as it sounds, silver could go to $44. I think there's a good chance that today was a break in that market that will lead to a longer correction. Gold never did what silver did. Gold had gone to had lagged silver on all of this move since the 25th of January, and silver kept making new highs day after day. Gold did not, and gold finally went up and surpassed its old high, which was $1,422.60, but then it couldn't get any higher than about $1,436. Now, that may sound like that's a new high, but the rule of thumb is that a new high has to exceed the old high by at least 2%. So that would have taken about a $1,451 gold price. We haven't seen that yet. The ratio has continued to fall, got to 39.665, which is about as far as my poor imagination could place it out there. But something else happened today, and you don't know. When you look at markets just for the day, you can see what you think is shaping up, but you don't know until that's confirmed by later market action. So what we've got, 3 days ago, we had a break day before yesterday, we had a break in the euro market. And the euro actually gapped down. And a gap on a market is a very, very dramatic move. It's not a move that we see very much. And then the euro...
And that's a liquid market. That's not a thin little market.
Oh, yes, yes. That's a very, very liquid market. So you shouldn't see many gaps in there. It traded sideways 2 days and then gapped down again today. Now, a gap shows huge momentum behind a move. And you see gaps when a market is getting ready to run away, for instance, or when a market has completely run out of steam. But when you see one at the beginning of a move like this, what it says to me is that market is really on the skids. It's getting ready to move a long, long ways. So let's put that together with the dollar, and the dollar appears to have bottomed. It the last 3 days, as the euro has fallen apart, the dollar bottomed, advanced well, closed up about 77.30 today, and that's all very, very strong if the dollar can keep doing that. What I've been looking for was some period of time where the dollar and hard assets would swap roles, because they don't just go in one direction forever. They zig and they zag. And, you know, the pendulum goes one way, then it goes another. And the Fed, of course, has been the best friend of silver and gold and always will be. And all of this QE1 and QE2 have put an announcement in the market in advance, we're going to inflate the currency a lot. And so that, of course, has fueled the silver and gold markets, and it's fueled it's fueled stocks too,
everything,
for slightly different reasons. So if we see that the dollar is turning up, that will put at the very least a headwind against silver and gold, at the very least a headwind. So I don't know if this is the top or not, or if they've got farther to go, if gold and silver have farther to run yet. It's not clear. One thing is clear, though. The stock market broke big time today. The stock market had already been in the embryonic stages of a downtrend, but in a fall from 12,400 down to 1,200. It bounced back up to the halfway point, which is a very, very common correction, and today it broke through 12,000. Today it fell 228 points, which is a very big move.
Right, it's a big fall.
Yeah, the S&P fell more than 2%. That was about 1.9% for the Dow. So what you've got now is the Dow Jones Industrial Average actually below its or right at its 50-day moving average, which is extremely significant, because when a market goes below that 50-day moving average, it means it has a lot of momentum. It means it's reversed its momentum. And so that's what we're looking at right now. I hasten to add, though, nobody should draw from this the conclusion that the gold and silver bull markets are over. This is just one of those zigs and zags that happens as a market advances. Another thing that I want to mention is, it took about 7 years for the silver market to go from $4, which was the beginning low, to $20.68, which was the high in March of 2008. That's a long time to make a fivefold increase. If you compare that to what's happened in the last 2.5 years, you can see that we're in the second stage of a bull market, because time and price are compressing. That is, the amount of time that it takes for a price to make a certain percentage move is much less than it used to be. And that's typical of bull markets. It's going to get, frankly, it's been taking, in the last 2 months or so, it's taken my breath away. It's going to get wilder still.
Right.
This is not as wild as it gets.
Right.
This is what you're just seeing is the bull market is stepping on the gas.
Right. It's very interesting. At the beginning of the year, and what I've been saying, day to day to day, is 70% chance we get a significant correction, 30% chance it just keeps going. And the danger is, for somebody who's new to the market and needs to buy, the danger is if you don't buy now, it could really get away from you. And, that's the danger, which is worse, buying now and having to live through a dip, or waiting and missing the whole thing. And what I've seen happen in the last week, and I take great meaning from what's happening at the state level on the precious metals legislation, is somebody at the top is pushing to accelerate. And that tells me, that the high on the 30% or the comeback on the 70% is going to be stronger than I expected this year. So, the politics of this thing are pushing for a higher price for the year. Does that make any sense?
It does. I mean, I understand your take on it. It's just going to be more volatile. Even
yep.
if all that weren't the case, even if there weren't an inside job pushing it, when you get to these stages, to this second stage in a bull market, it's going to be more volatile. And you have to have a stronger resolve and a very strong grip on the fact that you're in a bull market, you're in a primary uptrend, because if you don't have that strong grip, the bull is going to shake you off. You're
right.
going to get scared. You're going to get frightened, and you're going to say, oh, my goodness, I can't stand this. It's going to go down, and you're going to jump out long before time to jump out.
Right. This is no time to be out.
No.
No. Well, in fact, we have a question, so I know we've answered this many times, but we should ask it again. Some people are waiting for the gold and silver prices to decline before they purchase them. If they wait, might they be too late to purchase, and might the supply dry up or the price be too high?
You know, I get that might the supply dry up, and I'd just like to point out that at some price you can always buy gold and silver. There's, you know, at some price you can always buy it. There will come a time when we don't want to buy any more. That time is a long ways away. What people misunderstand is that they think they have to buy a certain price. They think, oh my goodness, I should have bought at $26 for silver, or I should have bought at $15 or something like that, when in fact you're not trying to buy a certain price. You've got a price rise that's going to last 15 to 20 years, and all you want to do is to take a piece out of that.
Right.
Just a big piece, the biggest piece that you can get. And so in that sense, it's not important when you get in, it's just important that you get in before things just completely get out of hand and run away.
Right. Klein said in her interview that 16 states were now pushing collective bargaining changes.
Huh?
And I found 10 states, I think, that are pushing the alternate currency. And one of the things that occurs to me is if we really do see states pushing to build the alternate mechanism, it's going to put gold and silver much more in the consciousness and make it much more acceptable for the retail investor to be participating. And that's a big, you know, again, the fixed income markets are huge. The bank deposit markets are huge. The precious metals markets are tiny in comparison. And so it doesn't take but a little bit of people finally realizing, oh, this is serious, for some money, more money to be coming in. Maybe, Franklin, you could explain a little bit about what the state and local proposals look like.
Well, the very best ones understand. Now, I'm going to say something that may sound a little arrogant, but I don't mean it to sound arrogant, okay? But please put it in the context that I've been studying the money issue since 1967, and that's a long time. And I've read thousands of court cases. I've studied the law. You know, I've read everybody's treatise on what the money system ought to be, from Bishop Nicholas O'Rame in the 12th century all the way up to the present. And there's nothing, I'm not sure that even sex draws out as many lunatics as monetary theory. It's just unbelievable.
It's absolutely true. No, it's absolutely true.
So anyway, let me just say that some of these are very good plans, some of them are very bad plans, and some of them are no plans at all. That is, they're only suggestions that like we have in Tennessee, that the legislature appoint a committee to study things, which I guess in the mind of somebody, a politician maybe, is action. But that of course, is not any kind of action. The very best plans understand that the transition from Federal Reserve notes to gold and silver currency needs to be made over a period of time to avoid disrupting the economy. And so these make silver and gold an alternative currency to the Federal Reserve note. And of course that alternative currency would only be inside the state. The best plans incorporate some sort of idea for electronic transfer, because gold and silver are at a competitive disadvantage if you have to actually use the coins, when bank electrons, which are basically Federal Reserve notes in electronic format or digital format, can be passed from hand to hand so easily with the swipe of a card. The best plan that I've seen is a two-pronged attack. Do you know, Patrick Henry opposed the adoption of the Constitution of the United States, and when someone asked him, why are you against it, he said, you give up the power, under the Constitution, you give up the power of the purse and the sword, and those are the only two powers worth having. They are all the power. So what these plans envision is that as soon as the state passes this Monetary Reform Act, that they will also, that every member of the state, every citizen, every male in the state between the ages of 18 and 60 is a member of the state militia, and that they are required as part of their membership in the militia to open an account to be able to pay in silver and gold. And so that would be a way of propagating these electronic accounts. I know that may sound awfully complicated. It's not quite as complicated as it sounds. But that you have to make this transition as convenient and non-disruptive as possible.
And so, now, all of them just proposed that this is that the mechanisms be created so that it can be an option for businesses who want to do it and parties who want to do it.
You understand that in the case of Tinder, the state is the biggest customer in the whole economy. And therefore, if the state says, this is the form you pay me in, then that will become the preferred tender in the economy. It's just that.
Right, but they're not saying it will be. They're saying it's one of the ones I will accept payment in.
Right, but it will rapidly, I assure you, if it's established, gold and silver will rapidly push Federal Reserve notes out of circulation.
Well,
now, let me say another thing about the best of these schemes. The best of them do not innovate. The best of them only do what already is in the law, and that is enforce the state's power to declare what tender is within the state. If you look at Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution, it says, no state shall make anything but silver or gold payment, but gold or silver coin payment and tender of debt. Okay, what that means is that the state does have the power to declare a tender. It only does not have the power to declare anything but silver or gold a tender. And therefore, this is all within the state's, well within the state's power. There's no question about that. And these are not innovative schemes in the sense that they would rewrite the Constitution or rewrite the laws. They only take advantage of the laws that are already there, already on the books. And so all they do is enforce those laws with existing coinage or with an electronic transfer system as an alternative. So,
now, of course, one of my concerns is once you create the mechanisms for the state to use it where somebody wants to use it as an option, you've then created the mechanisms to make it mandatory. And with this little gold and silver in circulation, and some of the other laws that are occurring at the same time or changes, that could be an extremely draconian event.
Right, and that's what the best of these bills try to avoid is that draconian event. But what you see is a threat in that event. You see, I mean, if everybody all of a sudden had to pay silver and gold in for all their debts or their taxes, where would they get it?
Well, they'd have to get it from the people who've been aggregating it or stockpiling it at low prices. In other words, if you look, you've literally had one, you know, sort of syndicate suppress the price and shift the gold into their own pockets at below market price, and then suddenly they let it rise and everybody has to come and get it from them. So to me, the pro-centralization team could make out like bandits on this if we're not careful.
Well, I think that's probably true. And, you know, you and I have talked about in the past, that the end of this game has to be a resumption of hard currency. The end of the game that's been played since 1913 or since 1873, depending on where you want to date it, the end of this game has to be to go in the other direction, to run in the other direction.
Right, and I have to say, given the push I've seen in the last week on state on the state proposals, I think it underscores the importance of having precious metals. If somebody in response to the question we just got, if you don't have any gold and silver, given the politics of where this thing is going, you want to make sure you do, and you certainly want to make sure you have physical too. Another good question that's come in as we're talking, Franklin, would the state policies, meaning the ones we're discussing now, reduce concerns regarding confiscation of metals, in your opinion?
Oh, yeah, sure. But I don't have any concerns about confiscation anyway. But yes, they would reduce that, because if they make silver or gold a mandatory or even alternative tender, then there's not going to be any confiscation.
Right. It's going to be the opposite.
Right,
they're going to want to see it going out, and a managed price that rises is something that's going to be good for them.
Right.
See, I always told you were going to get into alignment with Mr. Global. let's talk a little bit about some of the other things going on in the state, because for everybody's background, as you can probably tell from the blog post, I got all worked up this week about some of the politics I'm seeing here in Tennessee on the state level and around the country. And part of it is, you can have, we all know we need a sound currency. We all know the world's going to be better off with a sound currency, no matter what the short-term politics on it are, including who wins and who loses. But, I hate to look at any solution within one area without looking at the whole ecosystem, because to me the issue is who governs, who gets to decide, who controls. And at the heart of all solutions, you have to look at, I was talking to Franklin about this, because I called him today and ran about it, and I said, if you you can have the soundest currency in the world, and if the people you put in charge of it are a bunch of perverts, it's not going to work. So I hate to look at one piece of the solution, and sound currency is clearly one of it, without looking at the other pieces. And I'm sitting in Tennessee watching the alternative currency while food freedom kind of is struggling and dying on the vine. So, Franklin, I thought maybe we could talk through some of the different changes that are being proposed at the state level and see if we can't help people sort of see them whole. Is that are you ready?
Well, I'm ready, yeah. here's the thing, Catherine. It occurred to me a number of years ago, after all the years that I'd worked on monetary reform, that if we went tomorrow to a silver and gold standard, all right, let's say that I had the magic wand, and I could just wave the magic wand, and I could say, okay, no more magic money, no more creating money out of thin air, it's all got to be real now. What I would do is I would throw the emergency brakes on the country. It would lock up the entire economy.
You'd push the red button.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And the problem is, why would you do that to so many people? I mean, that's not to minimize the need for reform. And when the issue is moral, you have to reform immediately. You can't put it off. You can't say, well, we've been killing people for quite a long time in celebration of the weekend, and so we're going to really have to stop doing that. So this weekend we're only going to kill 8 people instead of 12. You can't do that with a moral issue, and it is a moral issue. But the problem is that the money supply, the system that has been foisted on us in the last 150 years is not, it has its tentacles everywhere. It has completely changed the American economy.
And culture. It's not just the economy, and culture.
Here, let me give you 2 examples of the culture. 50 years ago, 60 years ago, people had the desire to get their property paid off so they could pass it on to their children unencumbered. And that was especially true of farmers. People did not borrow money. Now, they were beginning to borrow money for some things, for mortgages and things like that. But by and large, people did not borrow money. There weren't credit cards. They didn't live on borrowed money. Today, they do.
Right.
Today, more than half of the people in the country draw their income from government spending.
Right.
In some states, it's 60%.
Right.
Now, what that means is over half of the people in that economy do not produce anything. They don't make something somebody else wants to buy.
Right.
And so when you've had an economy that has been literally gutted that way, you can't just go in and make one change and expect that to fix everything.
It's interesting. I had a wonderful subscriber send me an email this week saying, you know, barter won't work. He said, because you've got, and he's referring to the people anybody dependent on that money. He said, most people don't have skills that anybody with skills is willing to barter for.
Well, that's exactly right. They don't have skills. Not in that
right.
system. They don't, unless they're skills that they've got through a hobby. Like, for instance, they know how to run computers, or they have some form of craftsmanship or artistry that they can do.
Right.
But you're right. They don't have much to trade. And so they're not going to have much fun in a barter economy, because there's nothing there they have nothing to barter with. So yeah, that's true. But there's more here too, Catherine. You have to understand that the United States used to be the greatest manufacturing economy in the world. That's not true anymore. Those jobs have all been shipped overseas. Those jobs have been shipped to low wage areas. So the jobs that people used to do before the government began taking them on just simply aren't there anymore.
Right.
And this is the reason, I know it sounds awfully basic and fundamental, but this is the reason why the renewal has to begin with food.
Right.
We don't even grow our own food anymore.
Right, but we have arguably the richest collection of soil of any place in the world.
Oh, no question about that.
Right. So we have the capacity to start growing our own food very quickly.
Right. And we have the capacity to grow it cheaply and good. We don't
grow
good food. We grow a lot of food, but most of it's not very good. That is, not very nutritious. So what we have to do is to get, there's a moral and character problem that we have to address, and that is getting people to be just a little bit more self-sufficient. Just not a whole lot. I'm not talking about digging their own salt out of the earth and growing their own coffee in a greenhouse. I mean just a little more self-sufficient.
Right.
People have to become more discerning in how they live and how they spend their money. They have to become more discerning in looking at who they support with all the money they spend. You know, see, all this pro-democracy, spontaneous revolution in the Middle East, for instance, I sit back and I feel like somebody has thrown a bucket of hogwash over me. And I say that. Because you and I both know that for a people to be able to rule themselves, which is the best turn that we can put on the word democracy, for people to be able to rule themselves, they have to first govern themselves. They have to be able to govern themselves without a policeman standing over them. I'm talking about they have to be able to control their own wants and to direct their own activities. And so the more that you have a people who've been trained by public education not to think for themselves, to wait for the police to come, to wait for the expert to tell them what to do, the more people move in that direction, the more difficult it is to revive an economy, and the more impossible it is to have a truly representative government that protects and furthers human freedom.
Right. Without economic, any kind of economic self-sufficiency, there's there's no basis for a democracy.
Where do most people learn to be honest, self-sufficient, and productive? In their job. And
right.
if they don't have the experience of that in their job or in their training growing up, how are you going to give it to them when they're 40? It's a tough transition. It can be done, but it's a tough transition.
That's why when I was talking to the guys in Tennessee, I keep saying that the food freedom bills, we have one effort to try and get a bill introduced that will, and we've seen this in other states, will allow food to be grown and sold in Tennessee and take the position that it's not subject to federal jurisdiction. Because, and just that one change, if it happened in all the states, would make an enormous difference to how much income could be generated, you know, with small dairies and all sorts of different farming operations. Enormous difference.
Within 3 years of the time that was passed, you would not recognize the countryside.
Right.
And I'll tell you why. Because if you had just that one change, if you made just that single change, then what it means is that the cash flows, the huge cash flows that are now being diverted to Bentonville, New York, California, Florida, and all of these other places would be retained at home and build an economy.
Robin O'Brien, I talked about this last week, Robin O'Brien published an article recently and said for every Americans spend 9 cents out of every dollar on food and 16 cents out of every dollar on chronic disease. So not only would you generate significant income locally, and that's the basis of real serious, not just, you know, personal income, but equity. But you could really address the healthcare problem, because a lot of the healthcare problem is very much tied to bad food. So this is why I get very nervous seeing precious metals legislation go ahead of food freedom. Because the idea that we can't grow and sell food to our neighbors, but we have to pay our taxes and precious metals, just sends a chill down my bone.
Well, think about something else. Think about it from the standpoint of human freedom. What freedom do we have if we are not economically free? And if I'm not economically free to do business with you who lives next door to me or down the street, what in the world am I free to do? Vote
pay taxes. You're free to pay taxes.
Yeah, right. I mean, there is no freedom if you don't have that freedom. That is human freedom.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, and that's what this is coming down to. Well, let's turn, if we can. Before we go, we have a couple more good questions. I just wanted to mention, I posted a little post on the blog, the FBAR filings. Last year, we'd written an article about the proposed regulations. The final regulations have been promulgated. There's not any real change. If you go to the blog and check out the rules and click back to the June 30, you'll see the detail as it relates to depositories and accounts abroad. Ultimately, the issues are going to be what your tax preparer, or you if you prepare your taxes, decides, and that material is there to make life easier for you. Okay, ask question. Today I watched The Battle in Seattle, courtesy of Netflix. Based on the 99 protests of World Trade Organization conference in Seattle, we often ask you, Catherine, how do we impart to our families some of the stark realities we're facing as a people, a nation, humanity? When I try to discuss many of these topics, I'm turned off like a light switch. But we are a media-driven society, and so I'm realizing that making a meal and having people over for movie night seems to hold their attention and makes room for discussion. I want to thank you for your list of your top 25 videos, and would like to share this one with you and your readers. So I wanted to point out again, if you haven't taken a look at it, it's posted at the cart, and we sent the links out to the announcement with subscribers. I published a list of, it's called Our List of Documentaries in One Movie to Help You Organize Conspiracies to Grow Fresh Food, Finance the Gardeners and Farmers Who Do, and Inspire the Children You Love to Eat Fresh Food. And I think that's a wonderful comment from a subscriber. What I find is a lot of people don't want to talk about what's going on. They find it too depressing. They're afraid of change. And so you want to focus your conversation on what are the positive actions we can take to start building things that will really help us and work for us in this environment. And I think food is something that brings us all together, and getting people over to watch a video or a movie, particularly one that inspires them, is a really great idea. And I want to encourage you, even though this is for subscribers only, please feel free to share it with family and friends and use it as a tool in whatever way sort of will help you do that and do it in a way which is pleasurable and enjoyable for you, because Lord knows we need some rejuvenation and restoration, and I find watching documentaries to give that to me. A second question, the subject is on pension funds, CalPERS, largest pension fund in the country. My question is, should I quit my job just to get my money out of CalPERS? Of course, if I quit, I forfeit my medical benefits, too. I make about $90,000 as an engineer specializing in construction. I have about $200,000 of my money in CalPERS. CalPERS is starting to accumulate precious metals. I'm sure it's paper gold, though, and it's still a very small percentage of their total assets. My account, on and on and on. Caltrans layoffs are probably coming within 1 to 2 years max. I've worked in the private sector before, but if things get bad, I envision a grapes of wrath scenario where I travel around the country in an RV working on various construction projects until I can't get any more. Anyway, it's a tough decision. Thanks for your input. Well, I'm ready to take this, Franklin, but you got any thoughts?
Well, you know, the problem is that the writer is faced with a very radical choice. Does he want to make that kind of lifestyle change? And, you know, most people in the end will come down against that big a change, you know. It'd be a lot of fun to try.
Yeah, there's essentially, if you look at the information we have, it's not enough to make a recommendation. So I don't know. I think in situations like this, my guess is if you just looked at the cash flows, he's going to be better off by staying. The real issue is, if he leaves, will he be happier, and what can he build outside? So generally, my guess is that although the benefits will be debased, the cash flows will be better for staying. But it's a guess. Okay, let's go to the movies. I proposed that we watch National Treasure this week. National Treasure is arguably, and Franklin's seen it, not a very good movie. It's one of those movies, and you see books like this too, where literally somebody, and often in my experience, it's the intelligence agencies decide that they want a movie or a book made, and then pay a bunch of people a great deal of money to go off and do it, and it's never quite a hit. You'll see different movies like that. I call them recruiting movies. They're about military, and they're designed to get young men interested in being recruited into the military, and I think National Treasure is one of them. It's I once had a wonderful client up in New York who said, "How come to understand the world, I have to watch all the B-grade movies? That's the only way you explain the world." And this is definitely one of those B-grade movies. It was made in 2004. Nicolas Cage plays Benjamin Gates, who's a historian cryptologist who searches for lost treasure. And he's looking for a treasury which has sort of come down in the lore of his family that is supposedly once protected by the Knights Templars and hidden by the Freemasons during the early years of the United States. And a coded map on the back of the Declaration of Independence points to the location, and Gates finds the treasure, protects it from the bad guys, and turns it over to the Freemasons, who are fronted by an FBI agent who reveals himself at the end as a Freemason, and then announces that the treasure that has been found in the lower in the archives of Lower Manhattan, or you know, way down beneath Trinity Church, are now going to be essentially moved all around the world to help all of mankind. Now, what does this all mean? What is interesting is there were numerous among us in the financial markets who believe that 9/11. Was very much at the heart of a heist, both a movement of precious metals and gold out of Lower Manhattan, as well as the destruction of a lot of the documents related to illegal movements of large amounts of money out of the country using fraudulent government securities, including mortgage-backed securities. And I and other people have asked those questions and talked about that. But what's fascinating is you'll often see these horrible sort of B-grade movies used as steam valves. And it's kind of a way of saying, you know, I told you so. It's kind of a way of bragging about it. And after 9/11, we saw a series of different movies that that talked about sort of treasure or gold or fortune being stolen or moved out of lower Manhattan. There was another one with Bruce Willis where a bunch of guys steal a huge amount of precious metals. I think it's out of the New York Fed, which is where their huge stockpiles, supposedly. Anyway, and so it's always, national treasure's always been a nagging mystery to me because I always thought it was sort of the guys who engineered 9/11 saying, nah. But clearly it's an example of one of those steam valves. And I wanted to mention another story in connection with this, and one of the things that got me first looking at this question. I was in the middle of litigation and working with just an impossible number of Washington law firms. So I was in and out of Washington during the time of 9/11. And literally the day after 9/11, before 9/11, nobody ever mentioned Dubai. Nobody had any clients in Dubai. Nobody said anything about Dubai. Dubai was not on the radar screen. The day after 9/11, everybody had clients in Dubai. Everybody was going to Dubai. You sort of thought, well, what happened? You know, what went to Dubai? You know, what is this all about? And it was Franklin, I don't know if you realize this, it was in 2002 that the group that organized the Dubai Gold Exchange was set up. So right after 9/11, and then they launched in 2005. And so I, to this day, I scratch my head and I look at National Treasure and I say, what are they trying to tell us? Yeah. Because I think there's a message in it. And, you know, and it's this is all intuition. But it's a great example of one of those movies that's been organized to let steam out. And, you know, and it's very interesting to watch from a steam value perspective. I'm not sure it's great entertainment. But you've seen it. What did you think?
Well, I thought it was pretty bogus. But, you know, I thought it was awfully bogus when 9/11 happened that just not many months, I'm thinking, you know, 6 to 18 months before that, a lot of the vault service in New York had been concentrated there in the sixth sub-basement of the World Trade Center, which in itself is a little questionable, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, is it safer to have one big depository or a number of scattered depositories?
Scattered, so, always.
And the interesting thing was, it was like 4 days later, 5 days later, somehow or the other, they got an earth mold down there and tunneled in down five basements, and got all the gold and silver out and made a big point of the COMEX made a big point of making an announcement, oh, we got all the gold and silver out. Well, wow. Wow. That's some kind of efficiency, isn't it? Even for New York. So from that standpoint, I don't really... it's just bogus. It just smells bad, that's all.
Yeah, no, it does. It does smell bad. Well, the mystery never may be solved, but watch for those movies because they are, you know, there's more, they may be dreadful movies, but there's more meaning to them than you might think, and occasionally you pick up a little nugget. And remember, the guys doing this, you know, they don't get to brag about it. That's the problem with working on the covert side. As I always said about the Soprano TV show, they want their story told, too. Okay, well, that's it for today. Coming up next week, a great Soleri report. Janine Roth, best-selling author, just had Women, God, and Food up on the New York Times best-seller list forever. Known very much for her articles and books on food, she had all of her money with Madoff and lost everything on Madoff. Decided, no, I'm not going to let it get me down. I'm gonna sort of take this standing up and make it work for me. She came out with her next book. It's a bestseller, and it's a huge financial success, and she's basically back on top again. and hence the title Lost and Found is about losing all her money and then regaining it, and what she learned from that experience, and the extent to which it's really also an intimate exploration of why we allow fraudsters to play with our money, and what the deepest changes are culturally that we have to make if we're going to take responsibility for our money, understand where it is, what it does, where it goes, how it works, and how to make it work for us. So next week, Janine Roth, Lost and Found. That book's available on March 22nd. We're going to do the interview, but you can pre-order at Amazon if you want, and I recommend it. March 24th, Dr. Gwen Scott on aerosol spraying, mitigating the harm to your health, a very important Soleri report. You know, I don't like to talk about negative things, and this one is going to be one of the hardest Soleri reports you're ever going to listen to, but it is, it's going to have some very, very valuable information on the impact of aerosol spraying chemtrails on our health and what we can do to protect, and there's a lot we can do. I would point out Clifford Carnicom has two new pieces out on chemtrails and the relationship to biowarfare. One's up, the other will be up this weekend, and I strongly recommend both of them. April 7th, which is the first week in April, we have the first quarter wrap-up. I really encourage you before the wrap-up to read our year-end wrap-up. We wrote it up. If you go to your cart, you can find a link to the PDF. It's long, it's big, and it's a great framework for the year. Yes, it's fine to share it with your family and friends. I encourage you to do it. And, you know, if there's something you want us to address in the wrap-up, please send your request in to us or put it in the cart anytime. So until March 17th with Janine Roth, please remember, don't worry about whether there's a conspiracy or not. If you're not in a conspiracy, you definitely need to start one. Good night and good luck.